No light, no sound, no time nor space, utter void. Then somewhere the beginning of a pallor, and with it a faint throbbing buzz as of a ghostly violoncello palpitating on the same note endlessly. A couple of ghostly violins presently take advantage of this bass, and therewith the pallor reveals a man in the void, an incorporeal but visible man, seated, absurdly enough, on nothing. For a moment he raises his head as the music passes him by. Then, with a heavy sigh, he droops in utter dejection, and the violins, discouraged, retrace their melody in despair, and at last give it up. It is all very odd. One recognizes the Mozartian strain, and on this hint, and by the aid of certain sparkles of violet light in the pallor, the man's costume reveals itself as that of a Spanish nobleman of the 15th to the 16th century. Don Juan, of course. But where? Why? How? Where on earth or elsewhere have we got to from the 20th century? Another pallor in the void, this time not violet, but a disagreeable smoky yellow. With it, the whisper of a ghostly clarinet turning this tune into infinite sadness. The yellowish pallor moves. There is an old crone wandering in the void, bent and toothless, draped, as well as one can guess, in the coarse brown frock of some religious order. She wanders and wanders in her slow, hopeless way, much as a wasp flies in its rapid, busy way, until she blunders against the thing she seeks, companionship.
"Excuse me, but I am so lonely, and this place is so awful."
"A newcomer?"
"Yes, I suppose I died this morning. I confessed. I had extreme unction. I was in bed with my family about me and my eyes fixed on the cross. Then it grew dark. And when the light came back, it was this light by which I walk, seeing nothing. I wandered for hours in horrible loneliness."
"Ah, you have not yet lost the sense of time. One soon does in eternity."
"Where are we?"
"In hell."
"Hell? I in hell? How dare you?"
"Why not, Signora?"
"You do not know to whom you are speaking. I am a lady, and a faithful daughter of the church."
"I do not doubt it."
"But how then can I be in hell?" "Purgatory, perhaps. I have not been perfect. Who has?" "But hell? Oh, you are lying."
"Hell, Signora, I assure you, hell at its best. That is, its most solitary. Though perhaps you would prefer company?"
"But I have sincerely repented. I have confessed."
"How much?"
"More sins than I really committed. I loved confession."
"Ah, that is perhaps as bad as confessing too little. At all events, Signora, whether by oversight or intention, you are certainly damned like myself. And there is nothing for it now but to make the best of it."
"Oh, and I might have been so much wickeder. All my good deeds wasted. It is unjust."
"No, you were fully and clearly warned. For your bad deeds, vicarious atonement, mercy without justice. For your good deeds, justice without mercy. We have many good people here."
"Were you a good man?"
"I was a murderer."
"A murderer? Oh, how dare they send me to herd with murderers? I was not as bad as that. I was a good woman. There is some mistake. Where can I have it set right?"
"I do not know whether mistakes can be corrected here. Probably they will not admit a mistake, even if they had made one."
"But whom can I ask?"
"I should ask the devil, Signora. He understands the ways of this place, which is more than I ever could."
"The devil? I speak to the devil?"
"In hell, Signora, the devil is the leader of the best society."
"I tell you, wretch, I know I am not in hell."
"How do you know?"
"Because I feel no pain."
"Oh, then there is no mistake. You are intentionally damned."
"Why do you say that?"
"Because hell, Signora, is a place for the wicked. The wicked are quite comfortable in it. It was made for them. You tell me you feel no pain. I conclude you are one of those for whom hell exists."
"Do you feel no pain?"
"I am not one of the wicked, Signora. Therefore it bores me. Bores me beyond description, beyond belief."
"Not one of the wicked. You said you were a murderer."
"Only a duel. I ran my sword through an old man who was trying to run his through me."
"If you were a gentleman, that was not a murder."
The old man called it murder because he was, he said, defending his daughter's honor. By this he meant that because I foolishly fell in love with her and told her so, she screamed, and he tried to assassinate me after calling me insulting names.
You were like all men. Libertines and murderers. All.
And yet we meet here, dear lady.
Listen to me. My father was slain by just such a wretch as you, in just such a duel, for just such a cause. I screamed. It was my duty. My father drew on my assailant. His honor demanded it. He fell. That was the reward of honor. I am here in hell, you tell me. That is the reward of duty. Is there justice in heaven?
No, but there is justice in hell. Heaven is far above such idle human personalities. You will be welcome in hell, Signora. Hell is the home of honor, duty, justice, and the rest of the seven deadly virtues. All the wickedness on earth is done in their name. Where else but in hell should they have their reward? Have I not told you that the truly damned are those who are happy in hell?
And are you happy here?
No. And that is the enigma on which I ponder in darkness. Why am I here? I, who repudiated all duty, trampled honor underfoot, and laughed at justice.
Oh, what do I care why you are here? Why am I here? I, who sacrificed all my inclinations to womanly virtue and propriety.
Patience, dear lady. You will be perfectly happy and at home here. As the poet says, hell is a city much like Seville.
Happy here, where I'm nothing, where I'm nobody?
Not at all. You are a lady, and wherever ladies are is hell. Do not be surprised or terrified. You will find everything here that a lady can desire, including devils who will serve you for sheer love of servitude, and magnify your importance for the sake of dignifying their service, the best of servants.
My servants will be devils?
Have you ever had servants who are not devils?
Never. They were devils, perfect devils, all of them. But that is only a manner of speaking. I thought you meant that my servants here would be real devils.
No more real devils than you will be a real lady. Nothing is real here. That is the horror of damnation.
Oh, this is all madness. This is worse than fire and the worm.
For you, perhaps, there are consolations. For instance, how old were you when you changed from time to eternity?
Do not ask me how old I was, as if I were a thing of the past. I am 77.
A ripe age, Signora. But in hell, old age is not tolerated. It is too real. Here we worship love and beauty. Our souls being entirely damned, we cultivate our hearts. As a lady of 77, you would not have a single acquaintance in hell.
But how can I help my age, man?
You forget that you have left your age behind you in the realm of time. You are no more 77 than you are 7, or 17, or 27.
Nonsense.
Now, consider, Signora. Was this not true even when you lived on Earth? When you were 70, were you really older underneath your wrinkles and your gray hems than you were when you were 30?
No. Younger. At 30, I was a fool. But what use is it to feel younger and look older?
You see, Signora, the look was only an illusion. Your wrinkles lied, just as the plump, smooth skin of many a stupid girl of 17 with heavy spirits and decrepit ideas lies about her age. Well, here we have no bodies. We see each other as bodies only because we learned to think about one another under that aspect when we were alive. And we will still think that way, knowing no other. But we can appear to one another at what age we choose. You have but to wheel any of your old looks back, and back they will come.
It cannot be true.
Try.
17.
Stop. Before you decide, I had better tell you that these things are a matter of fashion. Occasionally we have a rage for 17, but it does not last long. Just at present, the fashionable age is 40, or say 37. But there are signs of a change. If you were at all good-looking at 27, I should suggest you trying that and setting a new fashion.
I do not believe a word you are saying. However, 27 be it.
What, Doniana?
What? You know me.
And you forget me.
I cannot see your face.
Don Juan! Monster!
You who slew my father, even here you pursue me.
Oh, I protest. I do not pursue you. Allow me to withdraw.
You shall not leave me alone in this dreadful place.
Provided my staying be not interpreted as pursuit.
You may well wonder how I can endure your presence. My dear, dear father.
Would you like to meet him?
My father here?
No, he is in heaven.
I knew it. My noble father. He is looking down on us now. What must he feel to see his daughter in this place and in conversation with his murderer?
By the way, if we should meet him...
How can we meet him? He is in heaven.
He condescends to look in upon us from time to time. Heaven bores him. So let me warn you that if you meet him, he will be mortally offended if you speak of me as his murderer. He maintains that he was a much better swordsman than I, and that if his foot had not slipped, he would have killed me. No doubt he's right. I was not a good fencer. I never dispute the point, so we are excellent friends.
It is no dishonor to a soldier to be proud of his skill in arms.
You would rather not meet him, probably.
How dare you say that?
Oh, that is the usual feeling here. You may remember that on Earth, though of course we never confessed it, the death of anyone we knew, even those we liked best, was always mingled with a certain satisfaction at being finally done with them.
Monster! Never, never.
I see you recognize the feeling. Yes, a funeral was always a festivity in black. Especially the funeral of a relative. At all events, family ties are rarely kept up here. Your father is quite accustomed to this. He will not expect any devotion from you.
Wretch, I wore mourning for him all my life.
Yes, it became you. But a life of mourning is one thing, an eternity of it quite another. Besides, here you are as dead as he. Can anything be more ridiculous than one dead person mourning for another? Do not look shocked, my dear Anna, and do not be alarmed. There is plenty of humbug in hell. Indeed, there is hardly anything else. But the humbug of death and age and change is dropped, because here... we are all dead, and all eternal. You will pick up our ways soon.
And will all the men call me their dear Anna?
No, that was a slip of the tongue. I beg your pardon.
Juan, did you really love me when you behaved so disgracefully to me?
Oh, I beg you not to begin talking about love. Here they talk of nothing else but love. Its beauty, its holiness, its spirituality, its devil knows what. Excuse me, but it does so bore me. They don't know what they're talking about. I do. They think they have achieved the perfection of love because they have no bodies. Sheer imaginative debauchery.
Has even death failed to refine your soul, Juan? Has the terrible judgment of which my father's statue was the minister taught you no reverence?
Oh, how is that very flattering statue, by the way? Does it still come to supper with naughty people and cast them into the bottomless pit?
Oh, it has been a great expense to me. The boys in the monastery school would not let it alone. The mischievous ones broke it, and the studious ones wrote their names on it. 3 new noses in 2 years, and fingers without end. I had to leave it to its fate at last, and now I fear it is shockingly mutilated. My poor father.
Hush. Listen.
2 great chords rolling on syncopated waves of sound break forth. D minor and its dominant, a sound of dreadful joy to all musicians.
Ah, Mozart's statue music. It is your father. You had better disappear until I prepare him.
From the void comes a living statue of white marble, designed to represent a majestic old man. But he wears his majesty with infinite grace, walks with a feather-like step, and makes every wrinkle in his war-worn visage brim over with holiday joyousness. To his sculptor he owes a perfectly trained figure, which he carries erect and trim, and the ends of his mustache curl up, elastic as watch-springs, giving him an air which, but for its Spanish dignity, would be called jaunty. He is on the pleasantest terms with Don Juan.
Ah, here you are, my friend. Why don't you learn to sing this splendid music Mozart has written for you? Unluckily, he has written it for bass voice. Mine is a counter tenor. Well, Have you repented yet?
Oh, I have too much consideration for you to repent, Commander. If I did, you would have no excuse for coming from heaven to argue with me.
True, true. Remain obdurate, my boy. I wish I had killed you, as I should have done, but for an accident. Then I should have come here, and you would have had a statue and a reputation for piety to live up to. Any news?
Yes. Your daughter is dead. My daughter.
Oh, the one that you were taken with. Let me see, what was her name?
Anna.
Ah, to be sure, Anna. A good-looking girl, if I remember right. Have you warned, what's her name? Her husband?
My friend Ottavio?
No. I have not seen him since Anna arrived.
What does this mean? Ottavio here? And your friend? And you, father, have forgotten my name. You are indeed turned to stone.
My dear, I am so much more admired in marble than I ever was in my own person that I have retained the shape the sculptor gave me. He was one of the first men of his day. You must acknowledge that.
Father, vanity? Personal vanity from you?
Ah, you outlived that weakness, my daughter. You must be nearly 80 by this time. I was cut off by an accident in my 64th year, and am considerably your junior in consequence. Besides, my child, in this place, what our libertine friend here would call the farce of parental wisdom is dropped. Regard me, I beg you, as a fellow creature, not as a father.
You speak as this villain speaks.
Juan is a sound thinker, Anna. A bad fencer, but a sound thinker.
I begin to understand. These are devils mocking me. I had better pray.
No, my child, do not pray. If you do, you will throw away one of the main advantages of this place. Written over the gate here are the words, "Leave every hope behind, ye who enter." Now think what a relief that is. For what is hope? A form of moral responsibility. Here there is no hope, consequently no duty, no work, nothing to be gained by praying, nothing to be lost by doing what you like. Hell, in short, is a place where you have nothing to do but amuse yourself. You sigh, friend Juan, but if you dwelt in heaven as I do, you would realize your advantages.
You are in good spirits today, Commander. You are positively brilliant. What's the matter?
I have come to a momentous decision, my boy. But first, where is our friend the devil? I must consult him in this matter. And Anna would like to make his acquaintance, no doubt.
You are preparing some torment for me.
All that is superstition, Anna. Reassure yourself. Remember, the devil is not so black as he is painted.
Let us give him a call.
At the wave of the statue's hand, the great chords roll out again. But this time Mozart's music gets grotesquely adulterated with Gernot's. A scarlet halo begins to glow, and into it the devil rises.
Have I the pleasure of again receiving a visit from the illustrious commander of Calatrava? Don Juan, your servant. And a strange lady. My respects, signora.
Are you...
Lucifer, at your service.
Oh, I shall go mad.
Ah, signora, do not be anxious. You come to us from Earth, full of the prejudices and terrors of that priest-ridden place. You have heard me ill-spoken of, and yet, believe me, I have hosts of friends there.
Yes, you reign in their hearts.
You flatter me, signora, but you are mistaken. It is true that the world cannot get on without me, but it never gives me credit for that. In its heart it mistrusts and hates me. Its sympathies are all with misery, with poverty, with starvation of the body and of the heart. I call on it to sympathize with joy, with love, with happiness, with beauty.
Excuse me, I am going. You know I cannot stand this.
Oh, yes, I know that you are no friend of mine.
Now, what harm is he doing you, Juan? It seems to me that he was talking excellent sense when you interrupted him.
Thank you, my friend, thank you. You have always understood me. He has always disparaged and avoided me.
I have treated you with perfect courtesy.
Courtesy? What is courtesy? I care nothing for mere courtesy. Give me warmth of heart, true sincerity, the bond of sympathy with love and joy.
You are making me ill.
There. You hear, sir? By what irony of fate was this cold, selfish egotist sent to my kingdom, and you taken to the icy mansions of the sky?
Though I can't complain, I was a hypocrite. Though it served me right to be sent to heaven.
Why, sir, do you not join us and leave a sphere for which your temperament is too sympathetic, your heart too warm, your capacity for enjoyment too generous?
I have this day resolved to do so. In future, excellent son of the morning, I am yours. I have left heaven forever.
Ah, what an honor for me. What a triumph for our cause. Thank you, thank you. And now, my friend, I may call you so at last. Can you not persuade him to take the place you have left vacant above?
I cannot conscientiously recommend anybody with whom I am on friendly terms to deliberately make himself dull and uncomfortable.
Of course not. But are you sure he would be uncomfortable? Of course, you know best. You brought him here originally, and we had the greatest hopes of him. His sentiments were in the best tastes of our best people. Will you remember how he sang? Well, he never sings for us now.
Do you complain of that? Hell is full of musical amateurs. Music is the brandy of the damned. May not one lost soul be permitted to abstain?
You dare blaspheme against the sublimest of the arts?
You talk like a hysterical woman fawning on a fiddler.
I am not angry. I merely pity you. You have no soul, and you are unconscious of all that you lose. Now you, Signor Commander, are a born musician. How well you sing. Mozart would be delighted if you were still here. But he moped and went to heaven. Curious how these clever men, whom you would have supposed born to be popular here, have turned out social failures like Don Juan.
I am really very sorry to be a social failure.
Not that we don't admire your intellect, you know. We do. But I look at the matter from your own point of view. You don't get on with us. The place doesn't suit you. The truth is, you have, I won't say no heart, for we know that beneath all your affected cynicism, you have a warm one.
Don't, please don't.
Well, you have no capacity for enjoyment. Will that satisfy you?
It is a somewhat less insufferable form of cant than the other. But if you'll allow me, I'll take refuge, as usual, in solitude.
Why not take refuge in heaven? That's the proper place for you. Come, Signora, could you not persuade him for his own good to try a change of air?
Can he go to heaven if he wants to?
What's to prevent him?
Can anybody? Can I go to heaven if I want to?
Certainly, if your taste lies that way.
But why doesn't everybody go to heaven, then?
I can tell you that, my dear. It's because heaven is the most angelically dull place in all creation, that's why.
His Excellency the Commander puts it with military bluntness. The strain of living in heaven is intolerable. There was a notion that I was turned out of it. As a matter of fact, nothing could have induced me to stay. I simply left it and organized this place.
I don't wonder at it. Nobody could stand an eternity of heaven.
Oh, it suits some people. Let us be just, Commander. It is a question of temperament. I don't admire the heavenly temperament. I don't understand it. I don't know that I particularly want to understand it, but it takes all sorts to make a universe. There is no accounting for tastes. There are people who like it. I think Don Juan would like it.
Pardon my frankness. Could you really go back there if you desire to, or are the grapes sour?
Back there? I often go back there. Have you never read the Book of Job? Have you any canonical authority for assuming that there is any barrier between our circle and the other one?
But surely there is a great gulf fixed.
Ah, dear lady, a parable must not be taken literally. The gulf is the difference between the angelic and the diabolic temperament. What more impassable gulf could you have? Think of what you have seen on earth. There is no physical gulf between the philosopher's classroom and the bullring, but the bullfighters do not come to the classroom for all that. Have you ever been in the country where I have the largest following? England. There they have great racetracks, and also concert rooms, where they play the classical compositions of His Excellency's friend, Mozart. Those who go to the racetracks can stay away from them and go to the classical concerts instead, if they like. There is no law against it, for Englishmen never will be slaves. They are free to do whatever the government and public opinion allow them to do. And the classical concert is admitted to be a higher, more cultivated, poetic, intellectual, ennobling place than the racetrack. But do the lovers of racing desert their sport and flock to the concert hall? Not they. They would suffer there all the weariness the commander has suffered in heaven. There is the great gulf of the parable between the two places, a mere physical gulf. They could bridge, or I could bridge it for them. The earth is full of devil's bridges, but the gulf of dislike is impassable and eternal. And that is the only gulf that separates my friends here from those who are invidiously called the blessed.
I shall go to heaven at once.
My child, one word of warning first. Let me complete my friend Lucifer's similitude with the classical concert. At every one of these concerts in England, you will find rows and rows of weary people who are there, not because they like classical music, but because they feel they ought to like it. Well, there is the same thing in heaven. Number of people sit there in glory, not because they are happy, but because they think they owe it to their position to be in heaven. They're nearly all English.
Yes, the Southerners give it up and joined me, just as you have done. But the English really do not seem to know when they are thoroughly miserable. An Englishman thinks he is being moral when he is only uncomfortable.
In short, my child, if you go to heaven without being naturally qualified for it, you will not enjoy yourself there.
And who dares say that I am not naturally qualified for it? The most distinguished princes of the church have never questioned it. I owe it to myself to leave this place at once.
As you please, Signora. I should have expected better taste from you.
Father, I shall expect you to come with me. You cannot stay here. What will people say?
People? Why, all the best people are here. Princes of the church and all. So few go to heaven, so many come here, that the blessed, once called the heavenly host, are a continually dwindling minority.
It is true. From the beginning of my career, I knew that I should win in the long run by sheer weight of public opinion. In spite of the long campaign of misrepresentation and calumny against me, at bottom the universe is a constitutional one, and with such a majority as mine, I cannot be kept permanently out of office.
I think, Anna, you had better stay here.
You do not want me to go with you?
Surely you do not want to enter heaven in the company of a reprobate like me.
All souls are equally precious. You repent, do you not?
My dear Anna, you are silly. Do you suppose heaven is like earth, where people persuade themselves that what is done can be undone by repentance? That what is spoken can be unspoken by withdrawing it? That what is true can be annihilated by general agreement to give it a lie? No. Heaven is the home of the masters of reality. That is why I am going there.
Thank you. I am going to heaven for happiness. I have had quite enough of reality on earth.
Then you must stay here. For hell is the home of the unreal and of the seekers for happiness. It is the only refuge from heaven, which is, as I tell you, the home of the masters of reality, and from earth, which is the home of the slaves of reality. The earth is a nursery in which men and women play at being heroes and heroines, saints and sinners, but they are dragged down from their fool's paradise by their bodies. Hunger and cold and thirst, age and decay and disease, death above all, make them slaves of reality. 3 times a day, meals must be eaten and digested. 3 times a century, a new generation must be engendered. Ages of faith, of romance, and of science are all driven at last to have but one prayer. Make me a healthy animal. But here, you escape the tyranny of the flesh. For here, you are not an animal at all. You are a ghost. An appearance, an illusion, a convention, deathless, ageless, in a word, bodiless. There are no social questions here, no political questions, no religious questions, best of all, perhaps, no sanitary questions. Here you call your appearance beauty, your emotions love, your sentiments heroism, your aspirations virtue, just as you did on earth. But here there are no hard facts to contradict you. No ironic contrast of your needs with your pretensions. No human comedy. Nothing but a perpetual romance. A universal melodrama. And yet you want to leave this paradise?
But if hell is so beautiful as this, how glorious must heaven be?
Oh, my God.
Oh, that was good. No, God. No, that is a mist.
You...
I didn't mean to... I beg your pardon.
Not at all. I interrupted you.
You were going to say something?
After you, gentlemen. You have been so eloquent on the advantages of my dominions that I leave you to do equal justice to the drawbacks of the alternative establishment.
In heaven, as I picture it, dear lady, you live and work instead of playing and pretending. You face things as they are. You escape nothing but glamour. And your steadfastness and your peril are your glory. If the play still goes on here and on earth, and all the world is a stage, heaven is at least behind the scenes. But heaven cannot be described by metaphor. There I shall go presently, because there I hope to escape at last from lies and from the tedious, vulgar pursuit of happiness, to spend my eons in contemplation.
Blah!
Senor Commander, I do not blame your disgust. A picture gallery is a dull place for a blind man. But even as you enjoy the contemplation of such romantic mirages as beauty and pleasure, so would I enjoy the contemplation of that which interests me above all things, namely, life, the force that ever strives to attain greater power of contemplating itself. What made this brain of mine, do you think? Not the need to move my limbs, for a rat with half my brains moves as well as I. Not merely the need to do, but the need to know what I do, lest in my blind efforts to live I should be slaying myself.
You would have slain yourself in your blind efforts to fence, but for my foot slipping, my friend.
Your laughter will finish in hideous boredom before morning.
Yeah. Do you remember how I frightened you when I said something like that to you from my pedestal in Seville? It sounds rather flat without my trombones.
They tell me it generally sounds flat with them, Commander.
Huh?
Oh, do not interrupt with these frivolities, Father. Is there nothing in heaven but contemplation, Juan?
In the heaven I seek, no other joy. But there is the work of helping life in its struggle upward. Think of how it wastes and scatters itself. How it raises up obstacles to itself and destroys itself in its ignorance and blindness. It needs a brain, this irresistible force. Rest in its ignorance, it should resist itself. What a piece of work is man, says the poet. Yes, but what a blunderer. Here is the highest miracle of organization yet attained by life, the most intensely alive thing that exists, the most conscious of all the organisms, and yet how wretched are his brains.
Did I not say when I was arranging that affair of Faust's that all man's reason has done for him is to make him beastlier than any beast? One splendid body is worth more than the brains of 100 dyspeptic, flatulent philosophers.
You forget that brainless magnificence of body has been tried. Things immeasurably greater than man in every respect but brain have existed and perished. The Megatherium, the Ichthyosaurus, have paced the earth with 7-league steps and hidden the day with cloud-vast wings. Where are they now? Fossils in museums? And so few and imperfect at that, that a knuckle, bone, or a tooth from one of them is prized beyond the lives of 1,000 soldiers. These things lived, and wanted to live, but for lack of brains they did not know how to carry out their purpose, and so destroyed themselves.
And is man any the less destroying himself for all this boasted brain of his? Have you walked up and down upon the earth? Lately, I have. And I have examined man's wonderful inventions, and I tell you that in the arts of life man invents nothing. But in the arts of death, he outdoes nature herself, and produces by chemistry and machinery all the slaughter of plague, pestilence, and famine. The peasant I tend today eats and drinks what was eaten and drunk by the peasant of 10,000 years ago. And the house he lives in is not altered as much in 1,000 centuries as the fashion of a lady's bonnet in 10 weeks. But when he goes out to slay, he carries a marvel of mechanism and lets loose at the touch of his finger all the hidden molecular energies, leaving the javelin, the arrow, the blowpipe of his fathers far behind. In the arts of peace, man is a bungler. I have seen his cotton factories and the like with machinery that a greedy dog could have invented if it had wanted money instead of food. I know his clumsy typewriters and bungling locomotives and tedious bicycles. They are toys compared to the machine gun, the submarine torpedo boat, There is nothing in man's industrial machinery but his greed and sloth. His heart is in his weapons. This marvelous force of life of which you boast is a force of death. Man measures his strength by his destructiveness. What is his religion? An excuse for hating me. What is his law? An excuse for hanging you. What is his morality? Gentility. An excuse for consuming without producing. What is his art? An excuse for gloating over pictures of slaughter. What are his politics? Either the worship of a despot, because a despot can kill, or parliamentary cockfighting. I spent an evening lately in a certain celebrated legislature, and heard the pot lecturing the kettle for its blackness, and politicians answering questions. When I left, I chalked up on the door the old nursery saying, "Ask no questions, and you will be told no lies." I bought a family magazine, and I found it full of pictures of young men shooting and stabbing one another. I saw a man die. He was a London bricklayer's laborer with 7 children. He left £17 insurance money, and his wife spent it all on his funeral, and went into the poorhouse with the children the next day. She would not have spent 7 pence on her children's schooling. The law had to force her to let them be taught gratuitously. But on death, she spent all she had. Their imagination glows. Their energies rise up at the idea of death. These people, they love it. And the more horrible it is, the more they enjoy it. Hell is a place far above their comprehension. They derive their notions of hell from 2 of the greatest fools that ever lived, an Italian and an Englishman. The Italian described it as a place of mud, frost, filth, fire, and venomous serpents, all torture. This ass, when he was not lying about me, was maundering about some woman whom he saw once in the street. The Englishman described me as being expelled from heaven by cannons and gunpowder, and to this day everybody believes that the whole of his silly story is in the Bible. What else he says I do not know, for the whole of it is in a long poem which neither I nor anyone else has ever succeeded in wading through. It's the same in everything. Highest form of literature is the tragedy, the play in which everybody is murdered at the end. In the old chronicles, you read of earthquakes and pestilences, and are told that these show the power and majesty of God and the littleness of man. Nowadays the chronicles describe battles. In a battle, 2 bodies of men shoot at one another with bullets and explosive shells until one body runs away, when the others chase the fugitives and cut them to pieces as they fly. And this, the chronicle concludes, shows the greatness and majesty of empires and the littleness of the vanquished. Over such battles, the people run about the streets, yelling with delight, and egg their governments on to spend hundreds of millions of money in the slaughter, whilst the strongest politicians dare not spend an extra penny in the pound against the poverty and pestilence through which they themselves daily walk. I could give you 1,000 instances, but they all come to the same thing. The power that governs the earth is not the power of life, but of death. And the inner need that has nerved life into the effort of organizing itself into the human being is not the need for higher life, but for a more efficient engine of destruction. The plague, the famine, the earthquake, the tempest were too spasmodic in their action. The tiger and crocodile were too easily satiated, not cruel enough. Something more constantly, more ruthlessly, more ingeniously destructive was needed, and that something was man, the inventor of the rack, the stake, the gallows, the electric chair, of sword and gun, above all, of justice, duty,
patriotism, and all the other isms by which even those who are clever enough to be humanely disposed are persuaded to become the most destructive of all the destroyers. All this is old. Your weak side, my diabolic friend, is that you have always been a dupe. You take man at his own valuation. Nothing would flatter him more than your opinion of him. He loves to think of himself as bold and bad. He is neither one nor the other. He is only a coward. Call him tyrant, murderer, pirate, bully. He will adore you and swagger about with a consciousness of having the blood of the old sea kings in his veins. Call him liar and thief. He will only take an action against you for libel. But call him coward. He will go mad with rage. He will face death to outface that stinging truth. Man gives every reason for his conduct save one. Every excuse for his crimes save one. Every plea for his safety save one. And that one is his cowardice. Yet, all his civilization is founded on his cowardice. On his abject tameness, which he calls his respectability. There are limits to what a mule or an ass will stand, but man will suffer himself to be degraded until his vileness becomes so loathsome to his oppressors that they themselves are forced to reform it. Precisely, and these are the creatures in whom you discover what you call a life force. Yes, for now comes the most surprising part of the whole business. What's that? That you can make any of these cowards brave simply by putting an idea into his head. Stuff. As an old soldier, I admit to cowardice. It's as universal as seasickness, and matters just as little. But that about putting an idea into a man's head, stuff and nonsense. In a battle, all you need to make you fight is a little hot blood, and the knowledge that it's more dangerous to lose than to win. That is perhaps why battles are so useless. But man will never really overcome fear until they imagine that they are fighting for a universal purpose, fighting for an idea, as they call it. Why was the crusader braver than the pirate? Because he fought not for himself, but for the cross. What force was it that met him with a valor as reckless as his own? The force of man who fought not for themselves, but for Islam. They took Spain from us, though we were fighting for our very hearths and homes. But when we, too, fought for that mighty idea, a Catholic Church, we swept them back to Africa.
What, you a Catholic, Señor Don Juan, a devotee? My congratulations.
Well, now, come. As a soldier, I can listen to nothing against the Church.
Have no fear, Commander. This idea of a Catholic Church will survive Islam, will survive the cross, will survive even that vulgar pageant of incompetent, schoolboyish gladiators, which you call the army.
Juan, you will force me to call you to account for this.
Useless. You know I cannot fence. Every idea for which man will die will be a Catholic idea. When the Spaniard learns at last that he is no better than the Saracen, and his prophet no better than Mohammed, he will arise more Catholic than ever, and die on a barricade across the filthy slum he starves in for universal liberty and equality.
Bosh!
What you called bosh is the only thing man dare die for. Later on, liberty will not be Catholic enough. Men will die for human perfection, to which they will sacrifice all their liberty, gladly.
Yes, they will never be at a loss for an excuse for killing one another.
What of that? It is not death that matters, but the fear of death. It is not killing and dying that degrades us, but base living and accepting the wages and profits of degradation. Better 10 dead men than one live slave or his master. Men shall still rise up, father against son and brother against brother, and kill one another for that great Catholic idea of abolishing slavery.
Yes. When the liberty and equality of which you prate shall have made free white Christians cheaper in the labor market than by auction at the block.
Oh, never fear. The white laborer shall have his turn, too. But I am not now defending the illusory forms the great ideas take. I am giving you examples of the fact that this creature, man, who in his own selfish affairs is a coward to the backbone, will fight for an idea like a hero.
He may be abject as a citizen, but he is dangerous as a fanatic. He can only be enslaved whilst he is spiritually weak enough to listen to reason. I tell you, gentlemen, if you can show a man a piece of what he now calls God's work to do, and what he will later on call by many new names, you can make him entirely reckless of the consequences to himself personally.
Yes, he shirks all his responsibilities and leaves his wife to grapple with them.
Well said, daughter. Do not let him talk you out of your common sense.
Alas, Senor Commander, now that we have got onto the subject of woman, he will talk more than ever. However, I confess it is for me the one supremely interesting subject.